The reason I usually remember to record this course is that the first item on my outline of what to talk about is recorder on, in boldface, because there have been too many times when I didn't. And I have, in fact, at this point, webbed the recordings for all except the first class. So, first one is, do you have any questions on what we did in the previous class? All right. You should have these things ready to go, because otherwise I'll go right past you. Second is, do you have any questions on the reading for this week? All right. Looking at what was covered in the reading for today, it seemed to me that I probably did not want to follow the order in which things were done in the book, because it was quite likely that we wouldn't cover all of it. And I thought what I would instead do is to first talk about several points where the book's article depends on economic ideas that are never really explained and that I could explain, then go on to talk a bit about the Baldwin and Levine chapter you've read, and then spend the rest of the class more or less starting at the beginning of it and going through different interesting things. So let me start out with what's going on contributory infringement, because that actually ties into a controversy in antitrust law, where the implication of what you're reading in the book is what I think most economists would regard as an obsolete way of looking at the economics of the problem. So let me start out with the situation, the Dawson case. And what's going on is that a company has a patent on a way of using a chemical. And it happens, apparently, this is the only way in which this chemical is used. So it's used in agriculture. So in principle, they could enforce the patent by finding every farmer who has bought this chemical and is using it and hasn't bought a license from them and suing them for infringement. But it's really hard to enforce something like that against, you know, a million people or whatever the number is. So it makes a whole lot more sense to try to enforce it against the people who are selling the chemical, because the company that's the defendant in the original suit is producing the chemical used and selling it with instructions on how to use it, that is, on how to violate the patent, assuming you don't have a license. And so Dawson, I think, are the plaintiffs, if I remember correctly. Dawson sues for contributory infringement and eventually wins. So it's a successful contributory infringement case. And the argument that's offered against this goes back to the argument in antitrust on what are called tie-in sales. So if you imagine that you're A.B. Dick and you're producing printers, this is an old case, and this isn't a copyright or a patent case, just a contract case. You say, I will sell you my printer on condition that you agree only to buy paper from me. All right? And then the question is, why do you do that? And the story, which is more or less echoed in the reading here, is you're getting a double monopoly. You're getting a monopoly paper on profit and a monopoly paper on printers. But that's wrong. And it's wrong because what happens, a monopoly doesn't mean you can charge any price you like, or rather you can charge any price you like, but you don't get people to buy things if the price is too high. So A.B. Dick is presumably already setting a price for their printers, which is high enough so they think if they raised it any higher, they'd lose more losing sales than they'd gain in prices. What happens if they try to use their monopoly on paper to charge more from the paper than it would otherwise cost? From the standpoint of a company that's thinking about buying an A.B. Dick printer, what has just happened? What?
They're not going to buy the printer.
Because the cost has gone up, right? That the higher price of the paper is an indirect price for the printer, right? So whatever the advantages the A.B. Dick printers have, I don't think they were the only printer company, but there must have been some reason why they had thought they had some market power. Whatever the advantages are, when you try to use your monopoly on paper in order to charge more for paper to go into your printer, you're raising the price of the printer. So you're not really getting a double monopoly profit. You're just getting your original monopoly profit in a different form. This is a better known later case involved IBM. And I used to tell this story as IBM computers until I actually looked at it and discovered it was before IBM was making computers. And they were making card sorters. It's I don't know if any of you have seen it, but sort of an early mechanical substitute for a modern computer was a machine where you had these punch cards, Holderith cards they were called, and you had information by the holes in them, and a machine could read that information, and you could say, here's a deck of cards. Each card represents a customer. We want to know the customers who live in zip code 95117. Put those into the machine goes through, it reads the stuff, and sorts those into a separate deck. So it was sort of a way of doing information processing with physical cards, which is sort of clumsy, but what they had before the modern computers. And IBM required you to buy the cards from them. So that's the more famous case. But the Dick case I actually like, because that's a case where one of the lawyers gave the modern law and econ our explanation of what was going on, which the courts didn't accept for, I don't know, another 40 years or something. Because the economist says, the next question is, well, if this is right, then why does Dick have this requirement at all? Aren't they just putting money into their pocket, into one pocket and taking it out of the other? Any guess as to why it would make sense for A.B. Dick to charge less for the printer than the price that they could have gotten and more for the paper? That's to charge partly in the paper. Any, what's going on? Yes?
Once you have the printer, there's stuff where I can get
them in. Well, but you know in advance that you're going to be stuck, so you're going to allow that cost, right? Let's think about it differently. Imagine you have a monopoly. Let's suppose I've got a monopoly on selling a book. What would I really like to do What I actually have to do is I say, well, you know, buy this book for $10 or don't buy it. But actually, out there in the world, there are some people who value the book at $8, which it happens is more than it costs me to produce it. If I charge $10, I can't get any money from them. There are other people who value the book at $12, and those cheapskates are only paying me $10 for it. What would I like to do if I could only figure out how to do it?
Different
prices to different customers. It's called price discrimination. All right, the sensible monopolist, if he can get away with it, where get away with it might be legal, it might be practical, you can give all sorts of possible constraints, would like to charge a high price to the customers who are willing to pay a high price and a low customers to those who, price to those who don't. Now, I'm a monopolist, and I, in fact, behave in this way, that I give talks, and if I have an invitation to give a talk somewhere by an organization that's willing to pay me a bunch of money to do it, or that I think is willing to, I charge a price. Occasionally, I'm asked to give a talk by an organization where it's an audience I'd like to talk to. I don't think they have very much money, and so I give the talk for free. All right? Same talk. And lots of other people do this as well. So price discrimination sounds like an evil thing, but in fact, it's a perfectly normal pattern of behavior. The problem is, how do you find out which customers will pay which price? Well, now think about A.B. Dick's situation. You sold the same printer to two different companies. One of them is using it to produce 10,000 pages a year, and one of them is using it to produce 100,000 pages a year. Which one do you think values the printer more? Clear? The one that prints more. On average, not perfect, but it's a pretty good sign. So if you charge a lower price for the printer and a higher price for the paper, you're indirectly price discriminating. You're indirectly getting the people who really value what you're selling to pay you a high price, whereas you're really selling people who don't value it as much for a price which is at least enough to cover your costs and a little extra, and low enough so they'll buy it. And I'm pretty sure it was the A.B. Dick case that at some point I came across the actual case, and there is one of the A.B. Dick lawyers saying, look, if we didn't have this and just made our money entirely from the printer, we would not be able to sell it at a price at which small printers would be able to buy it. Whereas that price is still more than the cost of making another printer. We'd like to sell it to them. But by doing it in this way, we can cover more of our costs from the big users and then give a relatively cheap price to the small users. So I think that's a plausible way. I think that's at least what most modern law and econ scholars would say is going on, that it's price discrimination. There are arguments for price discrimination. There are arguments against price discrimination. But it isn't the case that you're leveraging your monopoly to get two separate monopoly profits, which is what the sort of standard version used to be. Now, there are all these other explanations. I should say, if I go back to the IBM case, one explanation is exactly the same one, that they figured people who use a lot of cards probably value our sorters more than those who don't use a lot of cards. Another possible explanation is that they wanted to maintain their reputation for the quality of their card sorters. That depended partly on the quality of the cards being used, and therefore, if they made sure that they produced the cards, they could make sure the cards had high quality. Another possibility is they may have been bundling service agreements where they'd fix the sorter if it broke down, and again, they would then care about the quality. So there are other possible explanations, but the sort of standard law and econ antitrust explanation of tie-in sales is that it's price discrimination. But it's not clear that that's what's going on in the Propadil case, because there's another much simpler explanation of what's going on in the Propadil case, and that is it's a whole lot easier to sue one company than to sue 100,000 farmers. All right? Think for a moment about defamation law. If you didn't already know defamation law existed, you might say it's clearly unjust. All right? Because, look, I tell a lie about you to him. Well, do you have any right to have him believe the truth? Do you have a property right to the inside of his head? He chose to believe my lie. That was his decision. All right? So doesn't it look, if you just sort of think of it in sort of a moral standpoint, as though when I slander him to the world, if I'm cheating anybody, I'm not cheating him because he had no right to have people believe well of him. All right? Who am I cheating? I'm cheating all people who believe me. I'm swindling them. I'm giving them false information and pretending it's true information. So it would seem as though in a just world, the people who ought to be suing me for slandering him aren't him, it's all of you people. But that really doesn't work very well because the cost to each of you of having the false information is tiny. It therefore isn't worth your trouble. If it were worth your trouble, you wouldn't have believed me in the first place because you would have checked out that I was an unreliable source of information. On the other hand, the cost to him of having the world believe that he's an ex-murderer, whatever I claimed about him, is quite large. So therefore, he has an incentive to sue. So that it makes sense, if you're going to sort of think about justifying defamation law, that the logic of that is exactly the same as the logic of contributory infringement. That what's going on is that you have some wrongful act which involves small effects on many people. The legal system is very poor at handling small effects on many people. In both directions. That is, in the defamation case, the small effect is that I am imposing a small injury on all the people who believe my false statement. In the contributory infringement case, the small effect is that lots of people are imposing a small cost on me, namely violating my patent by using my patented process without permission. But in both cases, it's hard to use the legal system to deal with highly dispersed costs. And therefore, one tries in various ways to find one kludge or another that'll let you find a target, either a person to sue who has a large enough incentive, or a person either to be the plaintiff or the defendant, right? In the defamation case, what you're doing is making him a sort of a proxy plaintiff on behalf of all you people. And in the contributory infringement, we're making the chemical company a proxy defendant on behalf of all of the people who are violating the patent. All right, does that make sense? I think it's a useful way of thinking about that category of legal rule. Now, whether it's right or wrong, I don't know. As you may know, there have been serious legal scholars who held that slander laws and libel laws were violations of the First Amendment, that they're violations of freedom of speech. And maybe they're right. I mean, you could certainly make the alternative argument that it's really up to each person to decide what to believe and that you don't want to have the courts involved. But insofar as there is a good argument for defamation law, it seems to me it has the form that I've described. Now, the same problem occurs in other parts of the legal system. Class actions are another very clumsy mechanism for taking a dispersed cost, giving somebody an incentive to sue. Who has an incentive to sue? The attorney who claims to represent these 100,000 people who've never heard of him, therefore can collect $5 each in a settlement and can then pocket half that money as his fee and have the other money, theoretically at least, go to the victims through some indirect mechanism. All right? But all of these are really the same issue. Any questions? All right. Let me go on to the discussion of damages for the infringement of patents, because that article, which is again written by a law and econ type, is talking about property rules versus liability rules without ever explaining the idea of property rules versus liability rules. And if you think about it, I think I may have discussed this very briefly in earlier class. I have a right. I own my car. One way you could defend that right is to say if anybody violates it, things will happen to them so bad that people won't violate it. Another way you could defend the right is to say if anybody violates it, they owe me damages that compensate me for the damage done to me. Right? The first we call a property rule and the second a liability rule. So my standard example is you have a right not to have my car run into your car. And well, you might say you then have a right not to have me impose a chance of my car running on your car. It's a little less clear, but we're pretty sure that if I have a revolver with one bullet in the chamber and I spin the chamber and point it at you, I've done something wrong, even though it might be that the hammer is going to fall on an empty chamber. All right? So therefore, you might say that if you have... Either way, you have a right to have my car not run into your car, so the answer is that when my car runs into your car, I should be punished so severely that I will never impose any risk of that happening. All right? Well, that doesn't sound like a very good rule, because anytime you drive, there is some chance of something going wrong and of somebody's car getting dented. And we therefore instead try to enforce that right by a liability rule, which is that if my car runs into your car, I owe you damages that make you whole. All right, that's how tort law works. On the other hand, example I think I may have given a week or so ago, what about the use of my car? I have a right not to have you drive my car without my permission. And we could imagine a legal regime where you're in a hurry to get to the airport. There's a car sitting there on the street. You happen to have the necessary skills to hotwire it. You hotwire it, drive to the airport, leave it in airport parking, and fly off somewhere. And then the owner sues you for the inconvenience to him of having to retrieve his car. That's a possible legal system. Not a very good legal system, though. But that would be a case in which we use the liability rule in a system where we actually use property rules. What's the argument for it? Well, you can see the same thing with regard to patent infringement. All right? I infringe your patent. One possible approach to damage is to say, set the damages so high, people will never infringe patents. A different approach is to say, set the damages at the level at which infringing patents does no harm because the infringer has got to compensate the patent owner for what he loses as a result of the infringement, whatever you think that is. That's a more complicated question. You might say what he loses is the sales he could have made. You might say what he loses is the licensing fee he could have collected from the infringer if the infringer hadn't infringed. But in any case, those are two different ways you could look at setting damages. And in thinking about which one you want to go back to my earlier example and say, why do we use liability rules here and property rules there? Any guesses? Why don't we say that in order to drive my car, I must either impose zero risk of running into people or have permission in advance, just like the car? After all, I can rent your car. So you could imagine my getting permission in advance from everybody whose car I might run into, and now I'm allowed to pull out of my driveway. Why is that not a very sensible solution? Yeah? That is, a different way of putting is that the transaction costs of contracting with a million people are enormously high, so it's not worth the doing it. And you could imagine a case where you could do it, but it would be so costly to arrange the transaction that it makes more sense to do the other way around. Right? Imagine a much smaller population society, say. I was once told, it probably isn't true, but I was once told that there was some point early in the history of the automobile where there were only two automobiles in some state and they ran into each other. Now, of course, there may not have been a lot of roads that were suitable for them either, which could explain why that happened. But, right, now let's go to the other side, which is why aren't you entitled to just seize my car, use it, and pay damages? Why is that a bad rule? There are two problems with that rule, right? One problem is figuring out how much damage you really imposed. That the market solution is if you want my car, you make me an offer, and if letting you have my car for a week is worth more to you than it costs me, I'm willing to rent it to you for a week. That's what Hertz and Avis do, after all, or sell it to you for permanently. That's one way of measuring the cost to me. Whereas doing it in a court transaction involves the court somehow trying to guess how inconvenient it was to me. Well, I'll say it's hugely inconvenient. I want lots of money after all. You'll say, using the car anyway, and so forth. So one answer is that we would prefer the property approach, where it's relatively hard for courts to determine values and easy for the market to determine values. And again, where the transaction costs, if you think about the hot wiring car, I got to figure out who hot wired my car. He may not have left his card on it. Maybe we should say we have one legal rule if he does and one if he doesn't. This, by the way, is not a wholly imaginary example, to take a very different society from my other course. In Saga period Iceland, 1,000 years ago, the difference between killing and murder was that if you were a respectable law-abiding Icelander, after you killed somebody, you went to the nearest neighbor to announce it. All right, to say, I am so-and-so, I just killed so-and-so, he's lying over there, goodbye. And now the kin of the man you killed could commence legal processes to sue you for wehrgeld, for the damage for killing somebody. Whereas if you were a real illegal piece of scum, you killed somebody, hid the body, and went off and didn't tell anybody. And you would then be in much more serious legal trouble if it turned out that if anybody caught you. And more than that, you would be thought of as a bad person. There's this wonderful story in one of the Icelandic sagas, in Egil's saga, about this honorable Icelander who he and his buddies have gotten captured by some of the people they were raiding. They're Vikings. Grabbed the chest of silver and headed back to their ship. And they get halfway there, and Egil says, wait a minute, what are we, thieves? Egil, what are you? Puts down the chest of silver, goes back to the village, goes to the feast hall where the villagers are celebrating their victory over the Vikings, sets the roof ablaze before anybody knows he's there, picking up logs from the fire outside and sticking them under the eaves of the thatched roof. And when the roof of the feast hall is burning, he goes to the one door and says, I'm Egil Skalli Grimson. I've stolen your silver. What are you going to do about it? And kills everybody who tries to come out. See, he's an honorable guy. He's not a thief. He's just a robber. And robbing is not dishonorable, whereas secret taking is dishonorable. It's a wonderful example of a different society, but quite a fair. If any of you want some really interesting reading, by the way, the Icelandic sagas are really neat. We're talking about a society of 50,000 people nearly 1,000 years ago who wrote maybe more than a dozen books that are in print in English paperbacks. All right, so it's quite an impressive literary accomplishment. And they're good. They're stories. They're some mix basically of historical novels and histories. But that's one of my favorite little bits of it. Lots of other good stuff in Egil's saga, too. Too many digressions, too much to talk about. I'll tell you another story later, some other occasion. Anyway, so if you think then about the patent case, and that's the argument that's sort of being run through in a rather fuzzy and unclear way in the reading, is do we want to try to enforce patents by having a punishment for infringing so high that it doesn't pay to infringe, or do we want to do it by having a punishment such that you will compensate and you will therefore only infringe if the value to the infringer is greater than the cost to the patent holder, in which case if the infringer then compensates the patent holder, doesn't have any problem. What might be arguments against trying to have very high punishments in order that nobody would ever infringe? Why might that be a bad idea? Yeah? Yeah, that is one clear problem, is that just as you might accidentally have an auto accident, that patent law in particular, the boundaries are rather fuzzy. Even if the boundary is clear, if you've invented something for yourself, you may not know that someone else has a patent on it. All right, so that the high punishment imposes large costs on anybody else who is doing anything that might trespass and probably wouldn't. And you could imagine the same thing for trespass law. All right, we generally don't consider it legitimate in defending your property to plant landmines along the border. But if we really said it was absolutely essential that nobody trespass on your property, then we would say, all right, punishment for trespassing, you get blown up. Story I remember hearing about somebody who was sitting at home waiting to hear who had been stealing his firewood. He had a stack of firewood and wood kept vanishing, and he, you know, put up signs and did this and did that, and there's no way he could stop it. So eventually he took a stick of firewood, drilled a hole in it, put a stick of dynamite in it, and put it back on the pile. And he was waiting at home, sitting at home, waiting to hear who had been stealing his firewood. Again, that is not a legitimate way of enforcing your rights, at least under our legal system, though you could imagine some legal system where something like that was. Another issue which is mentioned very briefly, but it's an interesting issue, though not for IP in particular, but in general, is the issue of a probability multiplier. Let's take imagine we worry not about the problem of the trespasser not recognizing, but of the owner not recognizing. All right. Suppose I know perfectly well that you've got a patent, but I'm infringing it inside my own factory. My workers don't know you have a patent. They're not going to go tell you. So with any luck, I can infringe it and get away with it. And there's a really terrible case, which I wish I could, I ought to find it because it's an interesting case, in which the criminal in question was the U.S. government. That is, it was a case of somebody gets a patent on applies for a patent on a radically different kind of battery, and initially is told this won't possibly work. And it eventually turns out that I think the U.S. Navy has been hiring a company to make his patented battery for several years, and then I think tries to argue that the patent is invalid. But as I say, imagine a case where I've got a patent, and the chance that if somebody infringes it, I'll catch him is only 1 in 4. Well, if we want to adequately deter people, you ought to have a punishment which is 4 times the damage done, because you're only doing it 1 time out of 4. We generally don't do that. But, of course, the same argument applies to tort law. So that one of the interesting puzzles in tort law is why we have no probability multipliers. Why, if you commit a tort, and suppose it's a kind of tort where it's not always easy to know who did it, or to prove it, all right? If you think about, you know, in the real world, it's not like we have a perfect legal system which always gets the right results. So imagine that when you commit a tort, there's only a 50% chance that you will be sued and lose. That suggests that if we want to adequately deter torts, we ought to have a double punishment. And yet we generally don't. So that's, if you want to think about the legal system more generally, that's one interesting question to which I have only imperfect answers as to why we don't use such things. Anyway, those were a couple of the places where it seemed to me that there were economic ideas that I was familiar with and you probably weren't. In the one case, the tie-in sale controversy, and in the other case, the idea of property versus liability rules, and that you really needed them to make sense of the stuff you were reading. All right. Should I try to, in a case like that, should I try to get a day ahead? Should I have given this part of the talk Tuesday? Better or worse? Any opinion? Before or after you do the reading? Yeah?
I think it's good. It's good to explain, I think, afterwards.
Afterwards, because after you've seen, there's the puzzle, so to speak. Yeah. All right. Let me now go on. The next thing I wanted to talk about a bit was the Boldrin and Levine book, or the one chapter of it you read. And Boldrin and Levine say, look, it's clear that Watt didn't need his patent, or at least as long a patent as he had, because we observed that long before the patent had expired, he had already covered his costs. Is that argument right? Anybody want to tell me what's wrong with that argument? Why it might be wrong? Yeah?
Merely covering a cost may not be enough incentive on a mass scale to encourage people to bid earlier.
Because?
Because the higher the reward, the more people are going to go after it.
Well, but as long as the reward is greater than the cost, as long as you're being paid more for something than it costs to produce it, you would think that somebody would produce it. You only need to have one person produce it. Yeah?
He took a risk.
That's right. Exactly. You're observing the outcome of a gamble. You know, that's like saying that everybody who puts a dollar in the slot machine and gets $5 out, right thing to do, put the dollar in. Well, ex post it was, but ex ante it wasn't, because on average he's getting 50 cents out, or whatever the payoff of that slot machine is. So that was, in general, I think that Boldrin and Levine are making interesting arguments, and they may well be right in their conclusion, but I also think that, now, I'm not sure, by the way, if the webbed version, I actually got the published book, but I've been reading the webbed version because that's what you're reading, and it's possible they've corrected some of the things, maybe not, they've had my comments several years ago. But it does seem to me that there's a sense in which, although very interesting, it's a somewhat one-sided presentation. And that would be one example where it seems to me the argument is not as clear as they make it, although they certainly do give very real arguments on it. Now, there's a question which I think they might discuss later, but they don't discuss here, which is really a puzzle about why things happen the way they describe they're happening. That is, I'm assuming they've got the facts right. So the question is, somebody comes up with a considerably improved version of Watt's steam engine, and Watt sues him for infringement. What ought to have happened? What would you think sensible people would have done in that case? You're Watt and Hornblower, and the Hornblower, if I remember correctly, and that one is the other one. What should you be doing? It's just crazy for Watt to do what, according to the book, he did, which is to say, sorry, nobody can make the improved steam engine and for another 30 years or whatever it is till my patent expires. Yeah.
Wouldn't you want to, like, license it?
Yeah, of course. You ought to make a deal. You ought to say, look, your improved steam engine has cost me some sales, but it's going to make you much more money than it'll cost me because it's a better steam engine. Therefore, let's make a deal for what... And yet, apparently, Watt didn't do that. And there... For all I know, I haven't read, you know, any history on this beyond this book. Yeah?
I was just thinking that if we as a society give these patents to these inventors to encourage invention and to stop the help make the risk worthwhile, so we encourage risk-taking.
Yeah.
It's just, and if this is all for societal benefit, maybe the government should be the one that's in charge of... prosecuting the patent and the licensing of it?
Well, the problem with that, in a sense, is like the problem with prizes, which are another solution to the same problem, which is how do you discover what the right number is? And in particular, why do you think of the government as any more a neutral party seeking social good than anybody else in the game? That wouldn't you expect that in that case, whether the government set a high or a low license fee might depend on the campaign donations of the company that wants to, that has the patent and the company that doesn't have the patent. That, you know, if I think one of the, if you look at the history of Microsoft's legal troubles, I think it is reasonably clear that Microsoft in the early years made a serious mistake. They didn't invest enough in congressmen. And the result was that they got sued on antitrust grounds and had a good deal of trouble. And I think there has been a noticeable shift over the last 20 or 30 years to Silicon Valley companies having their own lobbyists in Washington in order to try to. But even if you imagine the government has the best intention in the world, it's not clear that it can do as good a job of figuring out how much the use of Watt's patent is worth to Hornblower as Hornblower and Watt can do in an arm's length bargaining.
The way that I think about it is that, and maybe I'm wrong, that maybe the government's a bit more accountable to society.
Well, that's interesting. I would have said the government is much less accountable society.
Than individuals?
Yeah, because of the fact that, look, in order for Hornblower to make any money, he's got to actually persuade somebody to be able to buy his steam engine. The person who wants to buy his steam engine has a very direct private incentive to figure out what it's worth to him because he's going to lose money if he doesn't. What incentive do you have to figure out whether the government's made the right decisions?
Well, if I personally am in the industry and I think the price is too high or too low, I think...
But you always, if you're the buyer, you always think the price is too high, and if you're the seller, you always think the price is too low. That's not informative. This is the democratic system. You're a voter. What incentive do you... Suppose that the patent holder is claiming that the government's giving away its rights for pennies on the dollar, whereas the licensee is saying, no, this is a perfectly fair arrangement. What incentive do you have to figure out who's telling the truth in order to know whether to vote for or against the current administration, which appointed the regulators, which set this up? What?
Well...
You are an individual. You only get to decide for an individual. You don't get to decide for the rest of us. Each of us only gets to decide for an individual. Right? You know, there's this famous quote from Churchill that democracy is the worst form of government ever invented by the mind of man except for all of the others. And that sounds at first glance like it might be an endorsement of democracy, but it's really a critique of government. He's really saying there aren't any good ways of running governments, or at least we haven't found any. And so the best one is still pretty bad. And it seems to me that that's as far as I know, that's a fair statement.
You know, each individual, they're going to law school, they're doing their own things, they can't involved in that, so obviously there's some form of delegation on these issues.
But the delegation is going to consist of whatever organizations or individuals have the greatest stake in the question, investing their time and money on lobbying and propagandizing and so forth. But consider any case where the beneficiary is one firm and the losers are 100 million people. The beneficiary's political influence is going to be enormously overweighted compared to the losers. See, the classic case for an economist is tariffs. Tariffs are import taxes. In the 18th century, reasonable people believed that tariffs were good for the country that imposed them. The modern analysis of the economics of trade was done by David Ricardo in the early 19th century. Since that time, I think you would have a fairly hard time finding a competent economist who thought that tariffs were generally good rather than bad for the country that imposed them. There are also almost no examples of countries without tariffs. All right, England in much of the 19th century had free trade. Hong Kong in the 20th century, both very successful economies. I don't know how many people followed Hong Kong, but Hong Kong in the post-war period is not only a very poor country, it is it's a crown colony. It has 10 times the population density of the most densely populated country in the world, which was Singapore. By what, 20 years ago, the per capita income of Hong Kong passed that of England. All right, it's really quite an astonishing case. And yet, the U.S. still has tariffs, right? We have some free trade agreements. But our free trade agreements are all based on the false assumption that the reason not to have a tariff against them is because they'll have a tariff against you. All right? The public picture of the tariff argument is that our tariff helps us but hurts our trading partners. Their tariff helps them but hurts us. So we can make a deal by which we'll both abolish it. But from the standpoint of the economics of it, that's like my saying, I'll stop shooting myself in the foot if you'll stop shooting yourself in the foot. But it makes perfect sense once we follow your argument through and we say that the Japanese government is not representing the welfare of the Japanese people. It's representing whatever is politically profitable for the parties in the Japanese government. U.S. government is similar. Well, the victims of a tariff are a very dispersed group. Namely, the consumers who are paying a higher price and the producers of export goods, because if we import less, we generally export less. The beneficiaries are a concentrated group, namely whatever the steel industry, the auto industry, whatever is being protected. Therefore, the consumers are willing to pay a penny on the dollar, much less than that, for what matters to them. The beneficiaries are willing to pay 50 cents on the dollar for what they want. Therefore, the beneficiaries' value is very, very heavily outweighed. So, I mean, that's unfortunately the problem. Well, I don't know. England has tariffs now, and they didn't have tariffs in 1850. That's regress.
My understanding was that in the, I know we're going way off here, in the 30s and 40s, that tariffs were part of the big reason why the Great Depression affected so many other countries.
Maybe.
Am I wrong? Maybe?
I don't know if you're wrong or not. I'm not a macroeconomist, and people argue about the causes for the Great Depression. But my point is only that if you actually look at the pattern, sometimes you move towards more free trade, sometimes towards less. And this is a question I think I raised, was it in this course or the other course, the question of the Whig version of history, the idea that it's steady progress. And maybe it's on net progress, but it's not very steady progress. So Germany from 1890 to 1935, that's regress, politically speaking. So I just want to go back to what I was saying before. An interesting puzzle to me is why Watt didn't license. And I should ask Levine. I know him, so I should ask what he thinks the reason is. And maybe the answer is that Watt was sort of an arrogant guy, and he thought I ought to control it all, and why should I don't know. But it's an interesting question, at least. Let me take another point where it seemed to me that they were overstating their argument. Or maybe you'll agree or not, and they say, look, the government doesn't enforce other monopolies, why should they enforce monopolies over intellectual property? But of course that isn't true. The government enforces my monopoly over my land. All right, I own a house. My house has got lots of fruit trees on it, because I've been planting fruit trees for the last 18 years since I moved here. And in principle, if you come on my land and steal my peaches, I got a lot of peaches still, so I don't really mind, but if you did, in principle I can call the cops and have you arrested. So that's a monopoly. It's a monopoly of a piece of land. So the real question is whether you think of ideas as things like pieces of land or as something else. And if you conceptualize the novel I wrote as a thing that belongs to me, then the government enforcing that monopoly is no odder than they're enforcing my monopoly over this phone. Whereas if you think of, no, the thing is the physical book, well, of course they can enforce, you can't steal my book, but if you bought my book, it's now yours, you can make any copy you like of it. So I thought there again, it just seemed to me that they overstated it. But I've been talked, but let's go back a step for a minute, because what's the obvious counterargument? Why might you say it makes sense for the government to enforce my monopoly of the cell phone, but not my monopoly of the book, of the contents of the book? What's the important difference there? What's special about IP? Yeah?
It's not a physical object.
Why does that matter? Why does that make it special?
It's much easier to tell, oh, he took my phone.
So one difference is it may or may not be observable, although in some cases, if you not only copy my book, but publish a copy, then I can probably catch you. Yeah?
You're really protecting also the manifestation of the IP. So whereas there's only one of that phone, you could directly make a whole bunch of copies.
Right. So in a sense, one of the really special things about IP is that you're using my book doesn't stop me from using it. You're using my idea doesn't, but you're using my phone does stop me from doing it. And you're picking my peach. While it's true that we tend to have an excess of peaches despite the visit of my grandchildren this weekend, which reduced that excess noticeably, so it doesn't hurt me very much, but there have been times when I've had few enough. I mean, if you had picked some of my pie cherries, for example, a couple of months ago, we never did get enough off that little tree to make one pie, and so I would have been really annoyed at you. So physical objects, we worry about the fact that one person uses it, another one can't. The others, we don't. But suppose for a moment that we had a form of property where your trespass did me no harm. All right? Might there still be reasons for enforcing my ownership of it? So let me suppose that my property is a lovely Japanese garden. And the Japanese garden has got walkways along it, and as long as you stay on the walkways, you're not disturbing the garden. But it's just beautiful to look at. All right? Why might the government allow me to forbid people from walking along that garden, even on the walkways, even though their trespass does me no harm? Yep. Why is there harming? What is the sense in where they're looking at it for free is harming me? It's harming me relative to what? It's not harming me relative to they're not looking at it at all.
Right.
What's it harming me relative to? They're paying me to look at it, right? So the argument there for the monopoly there, and that's quite analogous to the IP case. The argument is that while you're walking in my Japanese garden doesn't cost me any money, it would make me money if I could charge you for it. If I can't charge you for it, I may not create that Japanese garden or may not maintain it. And therefore, just as in the IP case, that one function of giving me the ownership is allocating things. That's not a problem with things where everybody can use them. But the other is getting things created in the first place, and there if I can't control it. So that's the argument that would be. And I think it's interesting seeing in what sense it does or doesn't parallel. So that the argument for IP is not as strong as the argument for my monopoly over my phone or my peaches, but it is as strong as the argument for my monopoly to keep people from trespassing in ways that do no harm, but that I might be able to charge them for if I had a monopoly. That's sort of the equivalent case. All right. I've been talking too much, which I tend to do, unfortunately. Do you have, just for a moment on the Bolden and Levine chapter, were there things on that struck you that you wanted to discuss or ask questions about or anything? No. All right. Let's say a bit then about the patentability of software and of algorithms, which is a noticeable chunk of one of the things the chapter is discussing. And could anybody sort of very briefly summarize what Don Chisholm's argument is for why algorithms and presumably computer programs ought to be patentable? Do people understand, by the way, the distinction between the role of patent and of copyright?
Yes.
because computer programs are copyrightable. That was an open question for a while. There were, in the early period, there were some courts which held that a computer program was not a writing because it was commonly embedded in a piece of, in a computer chip. It was written in a language, namely machine language, that almost no humans could read. So it was argued it's not really a writing at all. It's a CAM. It's a piece of machinery. And eventually the division among the courts was settled by Congress, which put in a copyright statute which explicitly said that programs were protectable. So what's the difference between patent protection and copyright protection for computer programs? Any difference at all? As you may have noticed, Pam Samuelson in the course of her piece is really proposing a version of copyright protection. All right, she doesn't call it that, at least in that particular piece. But when she says maybe we need a special form of IP rights for software, what she's suggesting looks more like copyright than like patent, although it's not exactly existing copyright. So what's the difference? Why do you care? You're a computer programmer. Why do you care whether your protection's... Yeah?
Sorry, I think I have this right. Right. So I believe that in copyrights of software, it's the actual source code, the actual configuration... Whereas in copyrights for software, excuse me, in patents for software, it's patenting the mechanism that's used to create
Yeah, that's the way of putting it. That is, your original statement was a little bit too narrow, because if you think about an ordinary copyright on a book, it also covers translations, so that derivative works. So it's reasonably clear that your copyright on your program not only covers your source code, it not only covers your object code. What if I took your source code, ran it through a different compiler, and therefore produced different object code? That would clearly just be like a translation, so that would do it. And I think it's clear, although it's not an area that I'm an expert in, that if I took your source code and rewrote it in a different computer language, but following the same structure I think that still would count as a derivative work. But if what I do is to say, aha, the clever thing about this program is that they have, as you may know, one of the things that programmers do in learning programming is what are called sorting algorithms. You've got a bunch of numbers. What's the quickest way of getting them into the order from lowest to highest? And there are a bunch of different ways of doing that. And so suppose I came up with a really clever sorting algorithm. If all I have is a copyright, there is nothing to keep you from reading my source code saying, oh, that's how he did it, and then writing your own program doing it. And in fact, as you may or may not know, the way the IBM PC was cloned was by a very much more elaborate version of that. The problem with cloning the IBM PC is that it had a whole bunch of software built into its hardware, built into the read-only memory, which was essentially the operating system or the sort of sub-operating system. And that was protected by copyright, so another company couldn't copy it. However, the details of that matter, because when you're interacting with the machine, you've got to say, put this number in this memory location, and X happens. So it wasn't enough for somebody else to write software that essentially did the same job, because if they did that, software for the IBM PC wouldn't have run on their machine. Right? They'd have to write it. What they did instead was what was called a clean room approach, in which you have two teams. Team A reads IBM software, reads the ROMs of the IBM PC, and writes a detailed functional specification. Not a specification of what the code says, but the equivalent of put this number in this memory location and that happens for everything. Team B is never allowed to look at the code, and they are instructed to write software that will exactly meet those functional specifications. Now, it may well turn out that what they write is very, very, very much like the original that they're getting, but they're recreating it de novo, and that turned out in the litigation to be considered legal. So that's a case where copyright, but patent, if there were original ideas, patent would go. On the other hand, of course, copyright has no serious requirement of originality, and therefore all of these sort of patentable requirements you can ignore. But basically one of them is in principle the idea that's in the program, and the other is in principle let's have a different question. The roughly speaking, the history of patentability of software is that the Supreme Court originally thought it wasn't. The Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit thought it was. And the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, through a long series of cases, dragged the Supreme Court kicking and screaming into allowing it to be patentable. By cases in which they essentially said, either we'll come as close to making a patent as we can, or else said, well, we really want to make it patentable, but the Supreme Court won't let us. And the Supreme Court ends up saying it's patentable if it's in some patentable process. Why does that matter? What's the difference between patenting my sort algorithm and patenting a machine where one part of my description of the patented machine is it uses my sort algorithm to do something in what it's doing? Why does it matter which of those I do? Which is partly why it's still an open question exactly how patentable software is. Well, suppose you have a patent on the sort algorithm. Who are the set of people who you can sue and collect? I mean, you can sue anybody, as you should know by now, but sue with a reasonable chance of winning. Anybody else who uses that sort algorithm for anything. But if what you have a patent for is using the sort algorithm as one part of this process for doing this problem, if somebody else uses some algorithm in an unrelated process, you got no handle. So it does, in fact, make some difference, although, again, it becomes very, very fuzzy, and there are people in this faculty who can tell you more than I can about where those lines get drawn and how. A number of Don Chisholm's arguments that struck me as interesting and not entirely persuasive, and partly, of course, that article was written a fair while ago, so we know things he didn't know. Is it clearly true, as he predicts, that the cost of writing software will be rising over time? That if you think about the arguments for a moment over both patenting and copywriting, I think a lot of people would say that the arguments for patents are a whole lot stronger for drugs than they are for software. And the argument for doing that would be the claim, which may well be true, that bringing a new drug to market costs a huge amount of money, and therefore you can't be expected to do it unless you can have a monopoly. How about bringing a program to market? Does that cost a whole lot of money, writing a program? I mean, I've done it, and I'm not a professional. I wrote several programs to go with a textbook I was writing because I had some ideas for how to teach economics. Any of you use apps on your cell phones? What kind of prices do you pay for them?
Zero.
Yeah, sometimes zero. Zero, $1, $3, $4. Some of the zero price ones, the maker has got a fancier version he's going to charge you for. But not all of them. And I think it's pretty clear, not just on cell phones, but more generally, that some noticeable number of those very inexpensive or free programs are a program somebody wrote for his own use. And he then said, well, other people might like this too. Great. You know, why not? Just as in the world of fiction, there's all this fanfic out there, a derivative stuff set in somebody else's universe, which is being done for free because people thought it would be fun to write it. And, you know, I mean, my daughter's been writing stuff since she was fairly young, but she won't let me see it because she's afraid I'll be critical. On the other hand, her brother lets me see his stuff. It's pretty good, actually. They're both adults at this point, but weren't when she started. So it seems to me at least dubious that his claim is right, just factually, on the evidence now. And that part of the reason is that at the same time that as computers get more powerful, you might argue you need fancier software for them. But there are two ways in which that's not true. One of them is that as computers get more powerful, the tools for writing the software get better and better. That everybody, every one of you probably, or almost every one of you, has better equipment for writing software than anybody had 30 years ago. Because you've got a laptop computer, which is more powerful than the big machines were 30 years ago. Furthermore, the software tools, you can get for free. The software tools for writing programs. You can also pay for them, depending on how fancy you want it. But there are much more development just in how you write a program. than there was even when I started doing it, let alone when it started. So there are things making it easier as well as things making it harder. And that, it seems to me, so that argument really cuts both ways. There's another feature which is less obvious. And that is that you can afford to write much sloppier programs nowadays. Because somebody I knew said that the way you figure, this was a long time ago, the way you figured out whether somebody was going to be a good machine language programmer was by watching him pack a car. Because if you're packing a car and you're good at it, you say, well, if I put this here, that'll leave just enough room. And it used to be the case that a noticeable amount of programming was like that, that you had very limited amounts of memory, and you therefore had to be very ingenious about how you fitted it all together so that if you're doing about the same thing in three different places, do them all in one place and then make tweaks sort of when you use each one, things like that. Similarly for speed, it used to be the case, and for some things it still is, but for a lot of things it isn't. It used to be the case that if you wanted your program to run and not crawl, you had to be reasonably clever about how you wrote it. All right, less and less true, because although it's true, I suspect, that if you're writing a first-person video game today, where it really matters that you be able to draw very complicated pictures very fast and move them, my guess is that that's still an area where you need really good programmers in order to do it better than your competitors. But an awful lot of software, your machine is already 20 times as fast as it needs to be. So if you're new to a clumsy job because you don't want to spend a whole lot of time fine-tuning it, so what? Now it's only 10 times as fast as it needs to be. So it seems to me if you actually look at this world that we're living in Silicon Valley, that Don's guesses about what's going to happen are not as not at all clear that they were right, and that I think you can make at least as good an argument in exactly the opposite direction of what happened. Another thing that sort of struck me there, and again, this may be partly because he was arguing a case, is that at one point, and I don't have the book with me, but you may remember where he says something to the effect that, let me see if I can find where it was. Ah, yes. Since patents may properly be granted only for new innovations, the result will be only to reward the people who make new things. All right. Is there something wrong with that argument? Since patents properly will be granted. So suppose I was arguing against gun control. And I said, look, there's no reason at all to restrict the ownership of guns. Because after all, guns will properly be used only for hunting and self-defense and those legitimate uses. Guns will never properly be used for bank robberies. So therefore, there's no reason to worry about keeping bank robbers from having guns. All right? There's an implicit identification of what's supposed to happen with what will happen. And that, it seems to me, is a very dangerous step in the real world. Because the obvious response to that is, well, it is true that patents can only properly be granted for new innovations. But how likely do you think it is that the judge who is deciding an infringement case has any least competence in telling what's a new innovation in software? All right. One of the things that has struck me in sort of my experience here is I don't have any data, but I would guess that when I came here about 18 years ago, probably a minority of my colleagues were using word processors. I'm not sure that's right. Might have had to go back a few years earlier than that. That in general, my impression is that the people who were sort of tenured professors 18 years ago were typically not very sophisticated with regard to computer kind of stuff. There were exceptions, of course. There were people who specialized in that. Much less true of the younger. The people who've come here since are much more likely people who are comfortable with computers, are used to them, just like you are. All right? Well, judges tend to be old people. All right? Especially Supreme Court judges. So that means that one of the real problems with making software patentable was that you have the decisions being made by people who weren't competent to make those decisions. Now, to some extent, you can get expert advice, you can get special master, you can do various things, but you may also end up with what at least a lot of people in the software world would say was happening, which was people getting patents on things that were perfectly obvious, things that people have been doing for 50, not for 50 years, but for 15 years or whatever, so forth. There's another new technology which may or may not be as important as software in your lifetime, and that's nanotechnology. Nanotech, as you may know, the real nanotech, not what usually gets in the news is nanotech. The idea is that everything humans build is very coarsely built, that the individual parts are quadrillions of atoms. Living creatures are engineered at the atomic scale. All right? The machinery that makes you and me work consists of single molecular machines called things like proteins and DNA molecules. And it's been argued for a long time, going back to Feynman, that if human beings could do engineering at the atomic scale, if you could build things where you were essentially putting each atom in a place to make your machine, you could achieve some very, very impressive results. What's referred to as molecular nanotechnology. Nanotech, when you see stories about nanotech, they usually just mean very small things. But the real idea, which a guy called Drexler was pushing for many years, but which Feynman started, is building molecular machines. So that, for example, you could build a cell repair machine. What's a cell repair machine? It is a very, very small submarine, engineered at the atomic scale, and it goes through your body fixing everything that's wrong, because it's much smaller than the cells of your body. One person came up with a design for an improved red blood cell. A red blood cell is basically an oxygen tank. Well, we've got oxygen tanks that have much more oxygen per cubic centimeter than red blood cells do. So his idea was you could build a nanotech oxygen tank that worked like a red blood cell, and you inject enough of them so that maybe they replace 10% of your red blood cells. And then one day you have a heart attack. So you call up the doctor and you schedule an appointment because you've got 3 or 4 hours of oxygen still in your bloodstream. Well, some of the people associated, there's a group, there's an organization in this area which has been pushing nanotech for a long time. And one of the things they were pushing a few years ago was the idea of setting up a database of everything anybody had done or thought about in nanotech in order to prevent patenting. All right. The argument was that if you are the first person to make a point of some nanotech idea, you might get a monopoly, even if it's obvious. And that a solution is, here is going to be a public database where anybody can put stuff into it, sort of like a Wikipedia kind of thing. And then when you try to patent something, we can point it and say, look, 3 years ago, so-and-so put that idea in the database. They wanted to get Santa Clara involved, and that's one reason I know about the project, though they didn't succeed in doing so. But I think there are a lot of people in the software world who have the same feeling, that their sort of feeling is this is just getting in our way, because for one really original, novel, great breakthrough, there are 100 things where trivial things that any of us could have figured out if we had to do it, and now somebody has a monopoly on it, and now I can't write my software without hiring a lawyer to go through the patent. Or a patent expert or something. So in any case, that's certainly an argument that gets made. On the question of, one of the discussions in the chapter is non-obviousness versus invention. All right. The idea is that for a long time, there was this somewhat fuzzy idea of a light bulb going off on your head, which somehow distinguished what was or wasn't patentable. And then when they revised the patent statute, they made it non-obviousness. Was anybody struck by Rich's explanation of why there was a certain amount of confusion as to whether they had or hadn't changed the law? What is Judge Rich, who at that time wasn't a judge, but who was part of the committee that proposed the revised law, why is it that people had this odd idea that all that the new patent statute was doing was slightly clarifying the existing law? Because they didn't think Congress would pass it if Congress thought it was a radical change. I'm not quite quoting, but I think if you really read what Rich is saying, what he is saying is we put one over on Congress. That we were in fact changing the law substantially, that the new version was consistent with some but nothing like all of the previous cases, that the Congress would have been scared if we said we are substantially revising patent law. So we put it as codification. We're just putting explicitly into the law what the courts are doing anyway. But then he's really annoyed about the fact that after that the courts say, well, look, since all we've done is put it, we can look at what the courts were doing 20 years ago and that'll tell us what the law is. And no, you're not supposed to do that. That's not what we did at all. You're supposed to look at the text we wrote and look, it's different. So it's an interesting question. Is that a legitimate argument to put to a judge to say, well, you can't take the history of what Congress said or what we said to Congress as evidence of what the law means, because we were actually lying to Congress. Well, not quite lying, just slanting the facts a little bit. You've just got to read the text. So anyway, I thought that was one of the funniest things about that passage, and I don't know if it occurred to Rich that there was something something wrong with the argument he was making, or at least something questionable. Let's go to one of the issues that gets discussed there, which is how do we prove novelty? All right, because it's not at all obvious how you prove novelty. There's sort of the sense in which everything is obvious once it's been done. And one of the questions which I gather is still running around the courts is, can you prove novelty by external facts? By the fact that this invention came in and the product embodying it was then a great success? Can you prove it by saying, look, 10 years before this invention, people were discussing in the trade publications, how can we solve problem X, and nobody was doing it. The invention solves it. That shows that it's novel. So what do you think? Are those good arguments for novelty? Can you think of reasons? There's a little bit of a discussion, not I thought that plausible, you might be able to do better, of why you might have something which appears and is very successful and yet wasn't novel. So how would that happen? Can you think of any examples where you would have an invention that was new in the sense that it hadn't been made before, but where the truth is that given a couple of years thinking about it, any competent person could have come up with it? What are reasons you might get that pattern other? That is, the argument is that if it hasn't been done, if it's successful, it's worth doing. If it's worth doing, it hasn't been done, it must be hard to do. That's the basic argument. So how might you argue that's not the case? All right, you're the attorney for the infringer, and the infringer says, yes, Your Honor, it is true that when our competitors brought out this widget, it was a great commercial success. And furthermore, it's true that we had a research project 10 years ago trying to find a widget that would do what this widget did, and we failed. Nonetheless, their widget is obvious. What kind of facts might you adduce if you wanted to sell that story? What's the critical kind of condition in which that might be true? Yeah?
There's some other, ketchup packets. A lot of it had to do with some machinery that might have produced this as an actual ketchup packet itself. It's something that was kind of obvious to a lot of people, but to actually make it saleable on a mass scale, that's not impressive. Yeah.
I was thinking marketing. I was thinking if a product comes along and you put it on a celebrity or you come up with a new name that sticks in people's mind.
But if that's all that's happening, then the other people aren't going to want to infringe it. Probably. The case I was thinking of was where the constraints on producing products had changed. Suppose what's going on is that there was no good way of solving the problem 10 years ago, including this way. But then last year, somebody invented a new something else, a new material, a new computer program. Maybe what's going on is that this new solution relied on cheap processors. And there weren't any cheap central processors 10 years ago. So that they could have done this solution 10 years ago, but the widget they were selling would have had to have an IBM mainframe attached to it. Well, nowadays, we just put a little embedded chip in it. But that embedded chip's only been available for 6 months, and these happen to be the first guys who saw the opportunity. Another 6 months, we would have done it. So that would be one possibility. Yeah.
Going off of that, it's kind of like when there are, for example, car accidents, and then you're in a case about the design of the car, they bring up the fact that if you are going to bring the alternative design test for it, then it has to be something that was the manufacturing, the available resources, and how to make it at the time.
Yes.
So that's right. Something that it does.
Right. So you could certainly imagine the case where we made this car 5 years ago, and the reason we did not, or 10 years ago, the reason we did not incorporate airbags was they hadn't been invented yet. That would be an extreme case.
Sure.
Yeah. Now, a different case, not quite the one I'm giving, but might also occur, is that perhaps it was a very successful innovation, but the conditions that made it successful changed. So the case I was imagining is suppose somebody comes up with a fine device for using natural gas in automobiles, a better way of storing natural gas. And they do it right now. They've just done it. And somebody says, well, to the competitor that wants to infringe it, if it was obvious, why didn't you do it 5 years ago? And his answer would be, 5 years ago, natural gas was not cheap. 5 years ago, now, I don't know, let me imagine it's the case, that natural gas was more expensive than gasoline, or at least not much cheaper. Therefore, there was no reason to want to do this. But fracking has driven the price of natural gas way down. I don't know if people have noticed, but you know, a few years ago, everybody was talking about peak oil and we were running out of oil. And then what happened? Fracking, it turns out, was not a new technology, but various related technologies developed in a way that made it much more productive. In particular, horizontal drilling, I think, was the critical one, I gather. And the result is that natural gas now costs, what, half as much as gasoline per unit of power. The result is that the U.S. has reduced its CO2 output, not because of any of the things we were doing in order to reduce our CO2 output, but because power companies switched from coal, I guess, mostly to natural gas, because natural gas became cheaper. And it turns out the natural gas produces, I think, about half as much CO2 per unit of power as coal does. So you could certainly imagine. So I guess the point I'm making is only that if you think about these arguments about external evidence, what you really want is there another explanation? The obvious explanation why nobody did it is because it was hard to do. And that's the explanation that the guy with the patent wants you to believe. So if you're on the other side, you want to say, is there some other plausible reason why no one did it before? All right. One point we made before, but I just thought I'd mention it because I can mention it in 30 seconds, is the claim is made that novelty means nothing is being taken from anybody else. But of course, what is being taken from other people is the opportunity for them to invent the same thing, which in some cases may or may not be valuable. One other point on non-obviousness is that non-obviousness, like a lot of other things in the law, is treated as a binary category, as if it either is or isn't. But surely it's really a continuous category, so that you could say, well, this is something which somebody would have invented next year if we didn't. This one, somebody would have invented it 5 years from now. That one, 20 years from now. So you've really got a continuous slide, and then it's not quite clear how the law can take account of that. And I've argued elsewhere that one advantage of trade secret over patent is that trade secret does give you that kind of effect. The incentive to come up with an invention which somebody else will come up with in 6 months is a lot less than the incentive to come up with an invention that'll take 20 years to do it if you're going to keep it a secret, because keeping it a secret doesn't do any good if somebody else invents it. But it does if they don't. All right, I think we're running out of time. I will now turn off my recorder, which I did indeed remember to turn on. Good thing.